honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode reflecting on the Battle of Iwo Jima through the perspectives of men from all branches of service who had converged on that tiny island 76 years ago. Remember, March 20th is the date for that special Iwo Jima Honor Walk organized by the Best Defense Foundation. You can participate wherever you're listening today, and you can sign up online right now. Check out that link at hometownheroesradio.com. I mentioned all branches of service, and often the Coast Guard gets left out. But that is the uniform Clyde McCully was wearing at Iwo Jima. 8 months earlier, he had landed troops at Normandy's Utah Beach on D-Day. At Iwo Jima, the landing craft he was operating, an LCVP from the USS Bayfield, served a different purpose.
My task there was primarily retrieving casualties and returning them to either one of the hospital vessels or our ship for attention. One of the disappointments, of course, is that you go in for a certain number of casualties and you find out that only a very few of them still had life with them. And for a good period of time, the boat that I had was used as a refueling station for the Amtraks that went in. The Marines used those quite a bit at Iwo Jima. It was an operation that just involved a tremendous amount of back and forth of vessels such as the Amtraks and the LCVPs to take ashore what really was needed. And, of course, the beach was very difficult to deal with because it was a type of volcanic ash that was very hard to gain traction on for some of the vehicles that were to be placed there. One afternoon when I went in to collect the what casualties we could find, it was so quiet. Nothing was happening. There was no mortar fire or any small arms fire that was coming into the beach at all. And sometimes I think that's worse than dodging, because you have a feeling they're just taking more careful aim.
That was Coast Guard veteran Clyde McCully. Among the Army personnel on Iwo Jima at the end of the action there was the 725th Medical Sanitation Company, a segregated unit of African-American soldiers tasked at times with cleaning up the carnage of battle. Fitz Albert Marius would go on to become a pioneering heart surgeon, but 76 years ago, his outlook, like so many others on Iwo Jima, could only handle one day at a time.
You have a war attitude that everybody is subject to soon death, including you. That's part of your everyday situation. You wake up, the more you protect yourself and the more you do right, the more potential you have of continuing another day.
And you mentioned that your duties at times included burying the dead. What was that like for you? How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
That was extremely challenging because now you are not talking about burying one or two people. You're talking about getting one of them big ditch diggers and digging out a big trench and then shoving in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 people and then covering them over.
Is that American? Is that Japanese? Is that both?
Both. Depending on the situation. Now, with the Japanese, you didn't worry about IDs and stuff like that. But with the Americans, you make sure you got the dog tags off of them so, you know, had identities. But you burying human beings with a bulldozer ain't fun. But you do develop a way of handling it so that you can survive, because you have to have an attitude of survival.
That was Dr. Fitz Albert Marius. And to conclude our focus on Iwo Jima today, I want you to hear from one more Marine. Ted Brodalski would go on to serve in the Air Force during the Korean War and Vietnam War, but at this point, 76 years ago, he was a 19-year-old in the 4th Marine Division.
I always kid the people that are my friends in the Navy that I'm mad at the Navy, because when I was in the Marine Corps, they told me I'd end up in the islands with palm trees, hula hula girls, and I get on this boat, and we get to this island, and they say, okay, you guys need to get off here. This is where your destination is. And by the way, this is Iwo Jima. There's 20,000 Japanese who want to kill you. And they're shooting at you. I was with the 4th Marine Division Command Post Air Liaison Section. We were aboard ship in the initial landing. The general and the staff didn't go to ashore till D plus 4. And I stayed with the command post, was right below Suribachi. Because when they took Suribachi, that was the fourth day. Up in that time, the Japanese were up on Suribachi in the caves and everywhere. And for the longest time, no matter where you were, with their tunneling set up, you didn't know whether they were going to show up behind you or anywhere. And so we were constantly concerned with the snipers. When we first landed, they had the whole island set up with trajectory. Their mortars and their artillery, they had the whole island pinpointed. So when they saw a bunch of troops together, they just went to their maps, took their mortars, and boom, they got right to the site. So during the whole island situation, we had 6,800 dead, 30,000 casualties. So you know that whenever they sent artillery or mortar or snipers, someone was going to go.
Well, and something tells me that some of those artillery shells ended up somewhere close to you at some point.
You know, people say, well, how did you get away without wounded or killed? And I tell them, you know, when that mortar came in, it landed 5-10 feet in front of me. The next one landed behind me. The next one to the left, one next. And that guy upstairs said it wasn't my time. That's the only thing you can say. There was no hiding. That was a volcanic ash. You couldn't dig down more than 12 inches without it coming back in. Luckily, all us guys were slim and young, so if you dug down 12 inches, that was to make sure none of your body was showing up for them to shoot at. And then later on, when we had the command post, we had sandbags and stuff. The whole time until we ended up at the end of the island, there was always activity going on. And the saddest part is when you saw the bodies coming back in the cemeteries on the beach. They just dug as low as they could, lined up the bodies and covered them over. And then later on, they extracted them to a different area. The one thing that when I saw the Flag of Our Fathers, do you remember seeing that movie? We took about 30 young Marines to see the movie. I had never been to a surround theater because we never went to the theater. And I'm sitting there, and as the mortars and the artillery's coming in, you swear it's going to land right on top of you. The shooting and the volume of the thing. So when we got out, one of the young Marines says, "Was that realistic?" I says, "Everything but the smell." Now, you know, when we went and had to get them out of the caves, we used flamethrowers. Probably the worst smell that they'll ever smell in your life is burning flesh. And we had burning flesh all over the place. And so you can think of all the other things that have happened, and that one thing that stands out that thankfully you won't replicate in life. And all I can say is that the good Lord was with me.
And this special Iwo Jima episode would not be complete without Ted Brodalski's memory of that famous flag atop Mount Suribachi.
We were on the deck. We were waiting to go ashore. And when the flag went up, we were out on the deck, and we saw the flag go up. You heard a big hurrah from the island. There was enough noise to move the island, but it didn't defer the Japanese. They didn't stop. So right after the flag went up, the general decided it's time to move the command post forward. So we went in right after the flag went up on the D plus 4.
So that was really your cue to land on Iwo Jima.
Right. It was our cue. And it was interesting because the colonel said to me, he said, "By the way," he says, "we have a Jeep for the command post, and you're the driver." And I saw all that going on the beach. Everything moving was getting killed, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm going to be a Jeep driver. But we never used a Jeep. Everything else was, we walked. But that would might have been interesting because the way it was set up with the two fields and stuff and the way everything was done. You know, the thing that impressed me when I got ashore, you know, they had the concrete bunkers. Then they had the underground setting where they went the whole island, tunnels, okay? We bombed that thing for 90 days. You go and look at the pillboxes, and you'd see a little dent about 6 or 8 inches off the concrete. Before we went in, the Navy battleships shelled that place for 30 days. We thought when we got there, there's nothing going to be there. There's no vegetation or anything else. But they were underground, and they were up in Sirbachi in the tunnels and stuff. And the minute the guys start landing, they just come out of their holes, and we had a full-force fight. And a Japanese general, there's 20,000 Japanese on the island, and a Japanese general was known to have said to him, "You will fight till you die. In the meantime, kill as many Marines as you can. You're not going to go back home." So, you know, that's the kamikaze type deal on the airplanes. They fought till they were killed. And there was just a few hundred of them that were in the caves that came out. But they kept fighting until it was over.
Well, and I've got to ask you, and you mentioned the shells landing 5 feet in front of you or 5 feet behind you, but never on top of you, never where you caught any shrapnel, and you felt that God was looking out for you. Do you remember one specific day or one specific experience, whether it was that or something else, that felt to you like the closest call or put the biggest scare into you as still a teenager in 1945?
The first night that we were ashore, remember now, all the supplies are coming on shore. Ammunition is loaded. There's stacks and stacks of ammunition on the beach. Well, the first night about 8, just after dark, the Japanese hit the dump. They hit one of the dumps. You've heard of star shells. That's the shells that go up in the, they come down in a parachute, light up. Well, that place was lit all night long from the shells. Well, by God, nobody was moving. You knew damn well that if you moved and there was someone out there, a sniper or so that was the one night that kind of got my attention that if we had been closer to the bomb dump, everything in the area was blown up. So I remember that well, and that's another thing that just being at the right place at the right time caused my survival.
Amen. Well, another thing that I have to ask you, because anytime I talk to someone who was at Iwo Jima, you have to hear about a Suribachi story and also the image. And here in your room, you have a smaller scale version of the sculpture that memorializes that famous Rosenthal photo of the second flag that went up on top of Iwo Jima. The original sculpture in Washington, D.C. near Arlington National Cemetery, the Marine Corps Memorial there, is so striking as it sits larger than life. When you see that, when you're just sitting here in your chair and you look over and you see that with the red, white, and blue sticking up above those soldiers, what does that mean to you? What's the significance of that image to you?
When we saw the flag go up, we were far away. We didn't see the people. But when we saw the flag go up, we thought we had won the island. So that gave everybody that extra little push, saying, "Wow, we've captured the island." Well, we got Sirbachi, which was a bunch of caves and stuff, and we cleaned that up. But then the rest of the island is like a pork chop. The other 2 or 3 miles was where all the Japanese were in caves. And so as the troops were going forward, you think that you're cleaning them out. In the meantime, they come in back. And one of the things I remember is the first fighter squadron that landed, Air Force Night Fighter Squadron. And they landed on the first airfield. The pilots were in their tents the first night. Japanese come out of their caves and stuff and killed a dozen of them. So you were never safe. And they would crawl around all over the place. And the way they hid the entrances to the tunnels, you never knew when they could come up and behind you. They had to, in the openings to the ones that the tunnels, they'd throw in the satchel charges, then they'd use the flamethrowers to get everybody away. But ironic, right below the tunnels was the raceway. They even had a hospital underground and all the ammunition and all everything, because they lived underground. So that the flag gave us a false sense of having gotten to the end, and it was, you know, that's D+4, and we went on till the end of the month.
The battle went a lot longer than the estimates were. So when you see it today, and you see the quote in Washington, D.C. at that Marine Corps Memorial, the quote on the side of it from Admiral Nimitz that says, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. What does that mean to you? And does that sound like what you saw and experienced as one of those Marines?
The Marines live by that creed. The Marines, since its inception, fought in every war and every conflict throughout the world. And the reason for the Marine Corps is, in the training, is a Marine will do his duty. There's never a hesitation. If the orders are to move forward, charge, and the firing is going around you, you're going to do what you have to do. The people we had on that island just kept doing their job, and that's why we were able to finally shut down the island.
The Marines, with help from the Army, Navy, Coast Guard, and Army Air Corps, secured that island 76 years ago, but the legacy lives on. And as we close, I'll mention once more, you can honor that legacy March 20th, wherever you are. Sign up for that honor walk with the Best Defense Foundation at bdf.org, or link to it from our site at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.